supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, now that the holidays are over, people's thoughts are turning to plants that they may have bought made of plastic this year, specifically the mistletoe they hung up. And they're wondering, could we grow our own for this coming holiday season? Will turn in an interesting answer after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Pauline, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Pauline. How are you?
I'm doing real well. How about you?
I am present and accounted for. Let's put it that way, Pauline. Where is Pauline doing well?
I'm gardening in Arapahoe, North Carolina, which is in eastern North Carolina on the coast.
Oh, okay. Arapahoe.
We're immediately on the Neuse River, and we're about 5 miles from the Pamlico Sound.
Oh, okay. Very good. That's an interesting area there. Very beautiful. What can we do for you?
We moved here 3 years ago, and it's the first time I have had a yard with pine trees. We have loblolly pines.
Mm-hmm.
I've always used shredded hardwood leaves to put in a leaf cage and save until they turn into wonderful leaf mold. But now I've got pine needles in the mix as well, and I'm not sure if they're going to be good to add to my shredded leaves or not.
Well, have you shredded them?
Yes, I always run over them with my battery-powered lawnmower.
How long does your battery last? I've been looking at these things.
Well, it's good for almost 2 hours.
Oh, that's more time than I want to be spend mowing to begin with. Okay. Well, I mean, these things do occur together in nature. I don't think it's going to do any damage. I might test the resulting compost if you can get a nice, easy pH tester. You know, either one of those handheld things or the bottle of strips that they sell at garden centers, and just test the finished pH of your compost, make sure it's not too acidic. And if it is, all you'd want to do is dust a little lime or wood ash in with it. Not a lot either. But don't the pine needles tend to stay underneath the pine trees?
Well, yes, except that we get some pretty strong winds off the river.
Oh, right, and right. Yeah, your water world.
Also, in using an electric blower to try and get the leaves into a smaller area, you end up mixing in the pine needles as well.
Do you have a reverse setting on that blower?
Yes, I do.
My advice to you would be when the deciduous leaves have fallen, to go out there with your blower vac, use the conversion kit, and they, you know, they call it a conversion kit because that's when you get religion, when you're sucking up the leaves instead of blowing them around, and try to get as much total leaf matter in that mix as you can. Now, obviously, you know, you're always going to be pulling some schmutz and schmageggy up off the ground, but, you know, try to just get the leaves, shred those as they go through the machine, use those for the compost. And mostly what I do, because I have a white pine in my front yard, is I just let those bad boys lay where they are because they make a beautiful mulch. Where did you move from?
Maryland. Our lot there was all hardwoods and no pines.
Right. The D.C. area of Maryland or northern?
No, D.C. area.
Oh, okay. Well, then you know, because that's kind of the turning point where the garden centers are just as likely to have bags of what's called pine straw for mulch as they are wood straw. You know, that's kind of the point at which it starts to turn over. Down south, pine straw is the mulch of choice. So I would say don't get all fussy and finicky about it, but get your leaves up first, and the smaller the number of pine needles you can mix into there, the better. And then I would try to rake up even maybe the pine needles separately, not shred them in any way, and use those as mulch on azaleas, rhododendrons, camellias, and especially azaleas and rhododendrons, because they have very fragile root systems, and we're not supposed to be walking near them. And so when you're outside walking in your garden, you try not to walk on the pine needles to begin with. So that's kind of a double reminder.
Okay, well, that would be great because I do have azaleas and camellias that might like that kind of mulch.
Oh, they will absolutely love it. That is their favorite form of mulch. And, you know, having pine needles in your compost means you're always going to be getting stuck. You know, you're always going to get little needle sticks in there. So you want to keep that stuff out as much as possible.
Okay.
All right, Pauline?
Well, thank you very much. You've been a big help.
All right. You enjoy your summer. I'm jealous already thinking about being that close to that beautiful water.
You have a good summer, too.
You, too. Take care.
Right. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Marion, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I am just great, Marion. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm calling you from Oklahoma City, and I enjoy your program
very much. Thank you so much.
And your program is very informative.
Well, thank
you. I have a question.
Go ahead.
I have a question about my hydrangea plant, flowers.
Right.
And this is my big dilemma because my house is south to north. I planted three hydrangea on south side of my house, and every year they change to a green, big, huge bush, but no flower. And I don't know what the problem is. I want to see their flower, but when I bought them, they had big flower, but that was it.
That's very common when you buy a plant that the flowers will have been forced. And sometimes it takes a couple of years for the plants to recover, but you've had these for longer than a couple of years, right?
Yes, it's been like 50 years now.
Oh, okay, yeah, so they should. You're a very patient woman, Marion. Now,
well, they are beautiful when they are green, you know?
Right. Now, are you pruning them?
Well, you know, I used to prune every year, but then I went to the Oklahoma State University and I asked that department and they told me you shouldn't prune. You should let it grow on old stems. So I quit pruning them, but no results.
Okay. So that's good. That's good. When did you stop pruning?
The year before last year.
Okay, good, good. I think we're in good shape then. Are they totally exposed? Have you had a couple of really severe winters?
Yes, we did. Yes.
Okay. First of all, I think the reason you didn't get flowers for the first decade is you were pruning out the old wood. And there are different types of hydrangeas. Some bloom on this year's wood. Some bloom on wood from the year before. And some don't know what they want to do. So the best way to keep any hydrangea looking good is to wait until the flowers form in the summertime. And then after all the flowers are completely formed, then you can prune out some old wood so you can see the flowers better. But in many parts of the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, no one has gotten hydrangea flowers the last 2 years because of the severe winters. The plants died all the way back to the ground and didn't start growing in enough time to produce flowers. They produced a lot of nice greenery, but no flowers.
Yes.
Are you feeding them or are they mulched?
Well, I just mulched them, but I didn't feed them any particular.
Now, what did you mulch them with?
Those red mulch.
So it's dyed red mulch?
Yes, yes.
I would move that as far away from the plants as I could.
Oh, okay.
Because your soil in Oklahoma City is already very alkaline, and these wood mulches tend to increase the alkalinity of soil as opposed to moderating it. And also, if it's dyed, there could be trash wood in there. So I don't think it's the reason they're not blooming, but it's no good for the plants. Anyway, first of all, if you have a normal winter this year, if you don't have a miserable winter, the plants will be fine on their own, and they're going to bloom for you next year. But we can never obviously predict winter. So the smartest thing you could do if you really want to ensure the blooms is get some burlap and put some stakes in the ground around the plant and just wrap burlap around the stakes so the bottom foot or 2 feet of the plants are protected from the wind. What's happening is the combination of the cold winters and your legendary winds. What you really need is a windbreak just to protect them from the winter wind. But you don't want to cover the plants themselves. So I would just give them a little winter protection this year, and I think you should be fine.
Okay, Mark. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you a lot. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Marion.
Thank you. Bye-bye, dear.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be delivering two workshops at the NOFA New Jersey Conference. That's the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New Jersey on Saturday and Sunday, January 30th and 31st at Brookdale Community College in Lincroft, New Jersey. But don't go looking for all the registration details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with fascinating facts about mistletoe and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, this past holiday had a lot of people miserable about their mistletoe because it was made of plastic or silk and not the real thing. Now they're wondering, could they grow their own passion plant? We'll tell you the surprising details after lots more of your fabulous questions at 1-888-346-9499. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, I'm Mike. I got to tell you, you have a great shtick. I mean, it's really a pleasure listening to you.
You're the first person to catch on that it is a shtick, or at least, say that out loud on the air, Jack. Congratulations. I feel like you should win a cash prize or something. Where is Jack?
I'm in Altoona, Pennsylvania.
What can we do for Jack up in Altoona?
Well, I've become quite intrigued with growing figs. And so I've got a small city plot that I've started to do intensive organic farming and gardening, rather. And I want to grow some figs. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if you can lay some hubris on me and help me with some varieties. And if I should go container gardening versus planting in the ground. I've got a nice southern exposure, gets 6 to 8 hours of intense sunlight a day against a small frame house that's painted white. I don't know if I should plant them in the ground or go with containers.
Now, if you read our online articles, you know, there are many people who are not comfortable that the named varieties of figs out there actually refer to anything specific. You know, there's the brown turkey, there's all these things. And in some cases, because it's not a really popular supermarket crop or backyard crop like tomatoes, the variety names can be kind of sketchy. Is there anyone around you who successfully grows figs?
Well, I'm just calling around now, and I haven't received any calls back. But, for instance, I've called the Greek Orthodox churches and the Italian churches to see if there are any people of those nationalities growing figs that maybe they've brought from the old country so I could get some dormant cuttings.
Right.
But I don't know of anybody, but I've just started checking around.
Okay. That's the best idea. If you can get a cutting from a fig that's already doing well in your area, that would be of benefit to you two ways. First, you'd know that that fig has the chance to be hardy where you are. And second, you'd have a fellow fig grower to hold your hand the first couple of years. Otherwise, you're just looking through catalog descriptions, looking for the winter hardy figs. If you're going to plant it in a pot, it has to be a really big pot. And what are you going to do with the pot over the winter time?
Well, I've got a cool place in the basement to put it.
And you can get it in and out easily?
Yes.
Even after it grows to like maybe 10, 12 feet high?
Sure, but I was thinking of pruning it down, you know.
You want to do as little pruning in the winter as possible. In your climate, you want to start with the biggest biomass you can. And one thing my friend Lee Reich and I have talked about is this dragon plants in and out for the winter is getting really old. I would suggest that you might have two other options. One, since you have such great sun in the back, plant it relatively close to the house, especially to plant it kind of in a corner and in an area where it gets all that sun. And then at the end of the season, just wrap the fig by putting up a structure in front of it and putting burlap up against that structure so that the fig is bordered by the house and burlap and it's not exposed directly to the winds. You'll probably have a little dieback on top that you would prune away in the spring when it started growing again, but the odds are really good that you could start the season with quite a bit of biomass on the fig. The other one is one that I was just looking at again the other day. I went back to an old issue of Organic Gardening where my friend Pat Capora and his father posed for the photo of our cover as they were pulling their fig trees out of the ground. Now, Pat and his dad are strongly Sicilian. Back then, they were growing 8 different figs in the Lehigh Valley, which is not as cold as Altoona, but you're getting there. You're not in the heat sink of Philadelphia or anything. And what they would do at the end of the season is they would rock the plants out of the ground and kind of prune them a little bit, but mostly just kind of tie them up as if you were tying up a Christmas tree to take it home, you know, really decrease the skirt, the width of the plant. And then they would dig a little hole, a trench, and put the fig tree down into the trench. And then they would cover it with whatever they had, old carpeting, soil, shredded leaves, anything like that. But it would be flat to the ground, and it would be a couple inches below ground. So in the springtime, they would uncover it, lift it up out of the ground, and 9 times out of 10, there would already be new green growth on it. And then they would just stand it back up, make sure the roots were nicely replanted. And that technique, the burying of the figs, that's as close as you can get to what a true Italian, a true Greek American is going to be doing to achieve that Mediterranean climate here in a hostile land. That's, and you're not dragging it in and out of the house. You're never going to have to face that one season where you blow out your arm or your knee and you can't do it. This is something you can get somebody to help you with and get done in half an hour. And it is probably going to preserve more of the plant than even a pretty heavy-duty structure with the plant standing straight up.
I'll give that really serious thought. It's making a lot of sense now talking to you.
No matter what else you do, you're going to have some winter death at the top of the plant. But this way, you really don't. You probably have a little frost on the part of the plant that's facing up, but you still have the full-size plant to start the spring with. And that's, you, even in Altoona, you might get two crops of figs a year.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, Jack.
Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Leslie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, thank you, Leslie. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. And you?
I am sitting up and taking nourishment. That's as far as I'm going to say.
Oh, my.
Where is Leslie?
I'm in Springfield, Missouri.
So what can we do for Leslie in beautiful Springfield, Missouri?
Well, I was calling about some information on a yucca plant in my yard.
Okay. What about it?
Well, I had an accident the other night. I don't see well at night. And I stumbled and fell into it. And punctured my arm with one of the stems. They're quite sharp on the end.
Right.
And it created quite a problem.
Now, yuccas are really well known as, you know, a very dangerous plant, not in terms of being poisonous or, you know, having a lot of silica in them, which makes them dangerous for, like, cats to nibble on, but their thorny leaves, so to speak, their very sharp leaves, are real widow makers. I mean, they are planted for three reasons. One of the reasons is, of course, their looks. They're a beautiful looking plant. They're kind of like desert alien plants. The second is once they grow to a certain size, they'll keep people away from that part of your yard. Like a lot of thorny plants, a lot of them are sometimes grown in a long line to keep kids from cutting across your yard and stuff like that. And the third reason is they're really wildlife proof. No deer, obviously, are going to eat them. Rabbits aren't going to eat them. They have no natural enemies, but I just opened up, when you said you had had a bad reaction, I opened up my Southern Garden book on yucca to see what it might say about anything like that. And the first thing it says is, for God's sake, don't plant this near a doorway or a walkway or any place you could stumble against it. So you cut yourself on it.
I did. I had a big scratch, and then one of them pierced my arm, and unbeknownst to me until about 3 or 4 weeks later, the end of it broke off in my arm.
Oh, my.
And it was quite a toxic type reaction.
Oh, yes. But I don't think that would be an allergic reaction. I mean, I remember a dear friend of mine almost killed himself because he broke a pencil point off in his finger, and he didn't do anything about it. And you say, about 3 months later, his finger swelled up to the size of his head, and he had severe life-threatening blood poisoning. So has the bullet been dug out by a surgeon yet?
Oh, I had to do it myself.
Oh!
Yeah. But I managed, and once it was out, it began to heal pretty quickly.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That's why God made emergency rooms and dock in a box, you know? Well, you know, one thing that you remind me, because we have been talking on the show lately, there's been a lot of talk about the thorns on firethorn, pyracantha, and people having reactions much more than just getting scratched by a thorn. And other people have commented that when they've brushed up against rose thorns in the spring, when the rose is actively growing, they seem to get a really bad reaction. And one thing that your comment makes me think is, you know, these plants are outdoors and they're exposed to all sorts of different things. And it would not be unusual for there to be a nasty organism on the outside of a plant, you know, say a bird pooped on it or the wind blew some, you know, nasty kind of mold onto it. So anytime you get a severe cut like that, I think you always have to think first, you want to try to reduce the amount of scarring you get. But second, you have to think, could this, you know, could I possibly now be infected if it broke the skin? Could something bad have gotten in there? And that reminds me of something that my family doctor made me promise I would do every year once I started hosting this show, which was to remind every gardener to get a tetanus shot.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Because we're always out there. Every one of us has rusty fences and tomato cages, right? And we're picking up suspicious stuff in the ground, and you get a cut in the garden. And a tetanus shot is a really good insurance against something really bad happening. So you, by calling in with your tale of woe, you're going to be responsible for hundreds of gardeners going out and getting shots that are long overdue.
Oh, good.
All right. And Leslie, you be careful out there.
I will. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I really love the program, and I have an issue that I would like some advice with.
Very good. Where are you, Mike?
I'm in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Very good. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, my mother has had a garden ever since she was a child, and she has arthritis, and so it's much more difficult for her to do the necessary upkeep of the garden. And she heard about straw bale gardening and that it would reduce weeding and that it would, she wouldn't have to get so low to the ground. And I wondered if that is a good option, or, and if you have any advice, if it is a good option as to how to get started.
Well, I mean, I will say that you're in a part of the country that's got a lot of straw bales for sale in the springtime. I am not a fan of straw bale gardening for several reasons. First, I'm an organic gardener, and all the straw and hay is certainly grown conventionally, to put it mildly. Second, it really is not going to raise things up as much as you're hoping unless you were to pile bale on top of bale. And then you kind of have to hollow them out and put some sort of soil in there. Most of the straw bale systems I've seen require chemical fertilizer. They dry out really rapidly, as you can imagine, because they're not they're not any kind of soil and they're not contained. They need a lot of watering. No, they would not develop weeds unless you actually made the amateur mistake of using hay instead of straw, and then they'd be growing wheat for you. I would recommend instead for your mother is something that I call tabletop gardening. Imagine going to a national park or a school playground and, you know, the big picnic tables they have there.
Right.
So cover the top of that picnic table with real planters, rectangular plastic planters. You make an investment at a garden center. And then fill those boxes with like half compost, half very loose potting soil. And then everything is at the right height. She can sit down on the benches and reach up and garden. You're not going to get any weeds because you're gardening in containers. It is the perfect situation to grow things like bush beans and cucumbers, flowers, herbs, peppers. I think the only thing that would grow too tall would be tomatoes. And so you can have containers sitting next to the table where that container goes all the way down to the ground. And then the part of the tomato plant that she'd be interested in anyway would be right up at arm height. I'm not getting any younger, and I don't enjoy bending over in the garden anymore. And more, doing variations on this tabletop. For instance, I had an old set of wooden patio chairs that had big, heavy arms. And then, like every real gardener, I had three kind of semi-rotted out wheelbarrows in the backyard.
Okay.
So I put the wheelbarrow trays on top of the arms of these chairs, filled them with potting soil, and it is absolutely the perfect height.
Okay.
So,
great.
Yeah, rather than fuss with hay bales or other, I mean, there's too many garden writers who will just write about anything new and not really think it through. Whereby okay. I'm thinking of something that's sustainable. Yeah, and you don't want to be buying 20 straw bales every year to start over fresh. You set up a system like this once, you do a little bit of investment in it, she can garden in that comfortably for the next 10 years without any further investment.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Mike. I'm an avid listener. I love your program.
All right. Well, good luck, Michael. I hope this works out for you.
Thank you, sir. Have a nice day.
You too. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will deliver workshops on beneficial insects and composting at the Northeast Organic Farmers Association Conference in New Jersey on January 30th and 31st at Brookdale Community College in Lincroft, New Jersey. Registration is still open and scholarships are available for beginning farmers. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with fascinating facts about mistletoe and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in just a little bit, this past Christmas holiday has people who are tired of plastic wondering, is there a way they can grow their own mistletoe? We'll explain what they might be able to do and why the actual growing is really hard after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Janice, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I am just ducky. Janice, how are you?
Thanks for taking my call. I'm good.
Where are you, Janice?
I'm in the marvelous neighborhood of Chestnut Hill in Philadelphia.
Oh, what a great neighborhood. Yes. What can we do for you?
My beloved brother sent me two beautiful bonsais
okay.
for Christmas. And I'm good at houseplants, but I'm totally perplexed and over my head with these.
Right.
Especially one that's a gardenia.
Mm-hmm.
So it says that they are winter hardy outdoor plants, that this is 6 years old and it's a height of 12 to 14 inches, and that to do well, it has to go outside. But I've never heard of gardenias lasting in Philadelphia outside. But that's why I'm calling you, Mike. Help.
What's the other one?
The other one's a boxwood.
Oh, okay. And both are what are called outdoor bonsai.
Correct.
Yeah. Outdoor bonsai do need to experience the seasons. Now, I presume these are in trays where the plants are wired down into the tray.
You're exactly right. They're in beautiful terracotta pots that are made for bonsais. They're beautiful.
And did they send you any instructions or just a little card that laughed at you when you opened it up?
Exactly. Just a little card that laughed at me. You overwinter your bonsai on the south side of your house by heeling in. I know all of what that is. And I did that to both of them when we had the 70-degree weather we had for the last couple of weeks. And they burst into, you know, foliage, all this bright green foliage started popping out. And then when it started to get cold, I took the gardenia in because I thought it would be too cold. I didn't take the boxwood in. So it's still nestled in the soil and some shredded leaves and in its pot.
But you have not pushed the pot into the soil?
No, I actually dug up some compost I have in the backyard and packed it around it is what I did.
Okay. Well, first of all, you don't need me to tell you that December was the warmest December in history, and a lot of people's plants were blooming. So these plants had a little bit of extra stress on them. Typically, the word with, quote, outdoor bonsai is you find a nice place to display them outside, like on a plant rack or a table. And then when the weather gets cold, you do exactly what the instructions said, which is to heel them in, which is to pack them down into very loose soil, but not plant them. And typically this is done pot and all. My biggest concern, oddly enough, has been the overriding amount of moisture we got at the end of the winter. The soil outside is still saturated.
Right.
So that's normally, I would have suggested you actually plant the pots in the ground, but I think you're doing the right thing so far because the ground is so saturated. And
okay, good.
One thing that these plants have in common with other plants is that wet feet will kill them. So describe to me what the gardenia looks like. Is it a very woody stalk?
It is. It says it's 6 years old, and it is a woody stalk at the bottom and out towards the branching branches. So I think it's been clipped a lot.
Oh, yeah. No, that's what makes them bonsai, honey.
Right.
Not only do they clip the top, but they'll need root pruning on a regular basis. You need to go down there under the soil, and you'll find that you see the little copper wires that are wrapped around some of the branches to direct them. Some of those copper wires are going to extend below the soil to keep the roots going in the direction they want. And a true bonsaiist would be constantly cutting a little off the roots as well as the branches every year to keep the plants compact. I'm going to suggest you're doing fine with the boxwood. For the gardenia, I'm going to suggest a cowardly path. What I would do is kind of like I'm doing with my rosemary. It's outside almost all of the time, and it comes in for short periods when I wouldn't put a dog outside.
Okay.
And then, do you go to the Philadelphia Flower Show at all?
Every year.
This year, go straight to the bonsai exhibit and throw yourself at their mercy. And by the time we get to next winter, you will know exactly what you're going to be doing.
That's great advice, Mike. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure, Janice, and best of luck.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com. and by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Steve. How are you, sir?
I can say I'm ducky as well.
All right. And where is Steve Ducky?
I'm in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin.
I always loved the name of that town. It just has a great ring to it.
Yeah, it's great. The Great North.
All right, what can we do for Steve in Chippewa Falls?
Well, a friend of mine is dealing with a yard of chaos, if you will. It is covered in weeds. In fact, I don't know if it's ever been a lawn. And it is also infested, if you will, with black locust stumps.
Now, you say black locust stumps. Black locust is a Native American tree that regrows from cut stumps. Was this a grove of black locusts that somebody cut down? And if so, are they regrowing?
Yes, they were all cut down. That was mandatory by the city. It was too overgrown in his yard. He was sick for a while and couldn't tend to it. And actually, there was a locust plantation, I think about maybe a little over 50 years ago, just around his neighborhood. So I'm assuming that that's where all of the locusts came from. To my understanding, black locust is a rhizome?
No, it's not a rhizome, but it kind of can act like one. It regrows from cut stumps. I don't think it's ever considered invasive because it's such a useful tree. It's one of the most rot-resistant woods that you can grow. It doesn't get the credit that cedar and redwood do, but it's just as rot resistant, and it's much more sustainable because you can regrow the same tree. You can harvest it carefully, and it'll grow again for you. So you're saying the city made him cut down the trees, and now he has this weedy area, and I'm presuming the city is demanding he do something with it?
Yeah, well, they're not demanding quite yet. I know that he bought the house about 10 years ago, and he was sick, so he couldn't tend to it. So now that it's been completely cut down, and it was mandatory because the city said, well, if, you know, your yard's covered in weeds and trees, and it needs to be so high, not over 8 inches. I don't know exactly what it is.
Oh, I hate these ordinances, so, yeah. And when were the locusts cut down?
Last year.
Okay, so we know that they're not resprouting.
Well, actually, he said that he was seeing some new sprouts.
Yeah. See, that's. I think they're just going to keep coming back up. I mean, the God's honest answer is if the gendarmes, the authorities, the jackbooted thugs are going to keep after him. The only answer is excavation, is to get those roots out of there. The other alternative is to have a different contractor come in and do what's called grinding, which is to probably cut more stump off and then grind what's left until it's at the soil line or slightly below. The honest answer is excavation would be, in many ways, maybe the easiest and the cheapest. Get all of the wood out of there, and then once he has a clean slate, he could do anything he wanted. The corollary is if you grind the stumps down, I would have a load of topsoil brought in and then try to establish whatever is the best ground cover for your area. Something that's fairly aggressive, but something that he can also keep in bounds with edging around the outside.
Like a fescue of sorts?
Well, that would not be a ground cover. That would be a lawn. And to do a lawn, you'd really have to get the stumps out of there, because the ground is full. What I'm saying is if you dump some topsoil on top and you got a ground cover that is not a lawn, it would spread and fill in these areas and maybe give a decent look. If he wants to have an actual lawn, I think those stumps have to go. There's just no easy answer there.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Okay, I really appreciate that. I love your show, by the way. It's great. I listen to the podcast all the time.
Oh, thank you, Steve. Good luck to you and your friend.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Can you grow the mistletoe? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started by reading this week's so intriguing question.
Sure, Mike, I'd be happy to. The recent holidays prompted Randy in Pica, Ohio to write, "I want to grow mistletoe. My husband passed away in April. We always had mistletoe during the holidays and always tried to get it fresh instead of plastic. He would have loved the idea of it growing in our yard. Internet research reveals that it's doable, but takes time and poses the risk of becoming invasive. And my landlord is not thrilled with the idea of my planting trees. Can you suggest a couple of trees that mistletoe likes that might do well in a pot?"
Well, I get to bail on her specific question for several reasons. First, MapQuest shows that she's located too far north to be inside the growing range of this popular parasite. Theoretically, mistletoe can be found in southern Ohio and Illinois, but it prefers much warmer zones. And as we repeatedly stress on this show, it's difficult to impossible to grow trees in pots in cold climes. And my research could not find anybody who is successfully growing mistletoe anywhere, although it is a popular cash crop harvested from the wild, mostly in Texas and Oklahoma.
On our recent Christmas show, we included an interview you did years ago with an Oklahoma extension agent who explained that people in his state usually, quote, harvested mistletoe from the wild with shotguns.
Oh yeah, people do shoot mistletoe out of trees. But I've become convinced over the years that they might like shooting things out of trees more than they like harvesting usable mistletoe, because one, it's an extremely fragile plant, and two, there isn't a really big market for mistletoe with buckshot holes.
Okay, so how is it properly harvested?
Well, first you have to find it, which is relatively easy if it grows in your area, because it's an evergreen shrub that grows high up in deciduous trees, and you're not going to start looking for it until after those trees have dropped their leaves.
And after you locate a patch?
Then you have to find out who owns the land and get their permission to harvest, which is generally easy to get, as there's a very common assumption that mistletoe weakens and eventually kills the trees it's inhabiting.
It is a parasite, so it does kill the trees, right?
Well, this is an area of great discussion. Mistletoe is a true parasite. Birds eat the famous berries, which are poisonous to us, poop the remains out onto the branch of a tree, and then the roots of the baby plant burrow into the branch and take nutrients from the tree. But the growing mistletoe plant also seems to have the ability to photosynthesize and provide some of its own nutrients, and many experts now feel that it doesn't harm healthy trees.
Doesn't it eventually shade the tree's true leaves?
Maybe after a couple of decades, but mistletoe grows very slowly. That's one of the reasons it's much smarter to find it in the wild than to try and farm it. It would take quite a few years to grow plants of any appreciable size. Anyway, once you do find it and get permission, you generally need a ladder, a helper, and a pole pruner. You use the ladder, steadied by the helper, to get up as high as you can, and then you use the pole pruner to cut off pieces, which ideally you catch in a net or something so they don't hit the ground. Mistletoe bruises easily. And while you or the final buyer may choose to replace the poisonous berries with artificial ones, you don't want them to roll away the second they hit the ground.
Wow, is this a big business?
Yeah, there's certainly money to be made. I found a bulletin on the West Virginia Extension website that talked about local harvesters gearing up to sell it at farmers markets, roadside stands, and a market in downtown Charleston. And they linked to a great article from a 1985 issue of Mother Earth News, where a West Virginia woman talked in detail about harvesting mistletoe and selling it from a card table at a local mall during the Christmas holiday season. She reported making several hundred bucks and having a lot of fun.
But you still don't advise planting it. Is that because it's invasive?
Again, that's a matter of opinion. Parasitic is not a synonym for being invasive. And the take on mistletoe has changed radically over the years. A great article on the Department of the Interior's U.S. Geological Survey website reveals that American mistletoe is a native plant that's been coexisting with our trees for the last 20,000 years, and that stands of mistletoe have been found to dramatically increase the diversity of important wildlife in areas in which they grow, especially desirable species of birds, butterflies, and pollinators. Now, if you owned a big woodlot in a prime growing area, you could certainly try to seed some of your trees, but it would be a slow process. I think it's much smarter to use the internet, which did not exist back when that Mother Earth news story was written, to connect with a harvester in a mistletoe-rich region who can ship it to you overnight. Well, that sure was some interesting information about mistletoe now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to all those different articles we just mentioned, click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to make off with my mistletoe if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you're certain that we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you will find the answers to all those questions you were about to email us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Adam Staniszewski. Staniszewski, what a wine. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Lauren Elkins keep our website free of parasites. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Al Banks is our editor. I'm your parasitic host, Mike McGrath, saying it's a good thing it's hard to get up at me here in the trees, or I might not be able to see you again next week. What do you get when you graft a dirt doctor to a fruiting spur? You get the 17th annual You Bet Your Garden Anniversary Spectacular with special guests Howard Garrett and Dr. Lee Reich.